This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. During the occupation of Wounded Knee in 1973, my guest Mary Crow Dog gave birth to her first child. She was there as part of the American Indian Movement, which was taking a stand against the way the tribal councils and the U.S. government ran the reservations. When Crow Dog tried to leave the reservation with her two-week-old baby, she was arrested. Mary Crow Dog has written a memoir about what it's been like going from a life of poverty on the Rosebud Reservation in South Dakota to becoming active in the American Indian Movement and marrying one of the movement's spiritual leaders, Leonard Crow Dog. Her new book is titled Lakota Woman. Mary Crow Dog went to a Catholic missionary school, which forced Native American students to give up their native religion and language. As a teenager, she became a heavy drinker and describes her life then as one vicious circle of drinking and fighting. Her life took direction in 1971 when she joined the American Indian Movement. She's reconnected with many of the old Native ways of life and continues to live on a reservation, but when she was growing up, her mother hoped that the family would assimilate.
They foresaw that it was a white world. It would be a completely white world, and to get along in a white system, we had to be assimilated toward the white way. In their thinking.
Were they very good at assimilating?
Well, my mother did real good. My mother is now a teacher, certified teacher. My mother did real good. She assimilated fine. And she is, you know, Christian. She lives that life.
So she doesn't live on the reservation?
Well, yes, she does.
Oh, she does?
She does.
Uh-huh.
She teaches on the reservation.
You never really knew your father. He left your mother, what, shortly after you were born? Or?
Right.
And he was mostly white, so you were considered a half-blood. What effect did that have on you when you were growing up on the reservation?
Well, it kind of hurt because I grew up in a full-blood community. And, well, it was all right when I was small because, like, when we played on a playground, you know, it was all right to... I could understand this and that, you know, the language a little. But my mother and my grandpa really didn't want me to talk Indian. And I even asked them over and over in my growing up years, talk to me in the language. And they said, no, you're better off without it. You know, because, well... Because of the schooling, the education.
You met people from the American Indian Movement when you were still a teenager, and that seemed to really change you from being a wild teenager into being a politically active person. How did you first come in contact with the American Indian Movement?
It was through the... my own personal contact was through the... occupation and takeover of the Department of Interior in Washington, D.C. And that was my first, you know, experience with the movement. I had heard, you know, of other things that they have done before that, which really turned me in a good way. It turned my mind, my whole mind around.
Well, how did it do that? I mean, what really reached you on a very personal and emotional level about the American Indian Movement?
When I was in school still, it came over the news that the American Indian Movement had taken over Gordon, Nebraska, protesting the death of Raymond Yellow Thunder, who was forced to dance naked waist down at gunpoint in a Legion Hall by some drunken rednecks at one night, and was later killed and stuffed into a back seat of the trunk car. And the movement... came in. Besides that, they would, you know, it was just really open racism and prejudice in that town. It's a border town. And things, you know, that's what really hit home is when you see an old man get abused like that, an old man that doesn't bother anybody, you know, getting tragically murdered like that. It does hit home.
You were pregnant at the time of the siege of Wounded Knee.
Yes.
Describe what was happening around you at Wounded Knee as you delivered your baby.
Well, there was I had two ladies with me. And one, well, three, actually. One was Annie Mae Aquash. Well, she was like my sister, my big older sister. She, you know, she always looked over me, you know, looked after me and made sure everything was fine. And there was another lady by the name of Ellen Mooskamp, who is a midwife, who is also a mother of a medicine man back home. And there was also this elderly lady. She's Potawatomi out of Kansas City, and she passed away a few years ago, but she is the one that born my son. And she was so cute because she was a elderly lady then, and when I went into labor and everything, she has this little derringer in her apron pocket, and she tells me, "Don't worry, nothing won't happen to you, I have this," you know, and she pulls out her little derringer. You know, little things like that were going on around me.
Were you afraid for your life?
No, I wasn't really thinking about my life at the time. I was willing to die for the cause, just to make a stand at Wounded Knee.
After the occupation of Wounded Knee, you married Leonard Crow Dog, who was one of the leaders of the American Indian Movement, and he was a medicine man. He had revived certain Sioux ceremonies. Your husband was imprisoned for, was it 2 years or 3 years?
2 years.
2 years, and this was after Wounded Knee. This was on charges stemming from Wounded Knee?
Yes, it was charges stemming from Wounded Knee.
When he got out of prison, you both returned to the reservation. Did you want to move back there?
Well, not really. I would have rather moved somewhere else where there wasn't so much bad memories, because when they came in on us, you know, they destroyed our children. You know, they couldn't really cope with what happened.
What do you mean when they came in on us?
Yeah, like September 5th, early one morning, they came down. There were about 250 U.S. federal marshals and FBI people coming down, and at that time, Leonard Peltier was underground, and Carter Camp was underground. These are Indian activists who were, you know, dodging the court system. And when they came in on us, they slammed our children around. They even kicked his mother in the butt, you know. They had no respect for anybody or anything. All they wanted, you know, they had Leonard out there on the ground, and, you know, M16s pointing at all of our heads, and they told us if we made a move, they'd shoot to kill. And so we know you have Leonard Peltier. We know you have him here. And they were already all over everywhere. They came in, there's just a little tiny river. They came down with these rubber rafts on the river. So they had the whole area covered. But no Leonard Peltier was found. But that was one of, like, an example, you know, an example of the lengths they would go to.
Now, your husband, Leonard Crow Dog, has been a leader of the Indian rights movement. He's also a medicine man and has been working to revive certain uses of medicines and plants, and also to revive certain Native American rituals. What are the expectations that he and others had of you as a medicine man's wife?
Well, to be there when, like for ceremonies, when somebody was in need of prayer, you know, like when he has a ceremony, depends on what kind of ceremony. You know, just to be there, supportive. And if, you know, there was any food that needed to be prepared, or if the people wanted to know what kind of preparations to do for a certain ceremony, I'd you know, be the one to tell them what to do and how to prepare. It would depend on what kind of ceremony it would be.
But you're right that confidentially it can be hell on a woman to be married to such a holy one. What's hard about it?
Well, it's like a 24-hour job. You just can't, you know. Oh, well, here, I'm going to only do this from 9 to 5, and after 5 o'clock, the door shuts. And I don't care who has the problem, you know. That's too bad. They'll have to wait till 9 tomorrow morning. See, I can't do that. You know, if people have a problem and they come anytime, you know, I'm, you know, expected to go ahead and go through with whatever is needed to be done.
Your husband is a medicine man. Can you describe what it means to be a medicine man now?
Well, now, it's just a difficult question because now, a medicine man, like Leonard himself, was apprenticed since he was a child. He was gifted with his way, with his spiritual way and his healing ways. Whereas nowadays, today, you're going to see all kinds of medicine people, medicine women, medicine men. And now there is a lot of abuse going on with our Indian religion. And it's a shame. It's a shame that, you know, that people can get away with this kind of thing. And some people out there are so naive, they'll believe anything, you know. But a medicine man is real. He has to be real. He has to have the gift from the Great Spirit, or as you would put it, the power of God.
See, you're saying that there's a lot of frauds now.
Yes, there is.
And there's no way of controlling that, I guess.
Well, it should be controlled, because what we're worried about is the abuse that goes on with our religion. Our religion's going to end up getting outlawed again. And that's what we're really worried about.
During what period was your religion outlawed? And, you know, when was it?
When
was it legalized again? Or not prohibited, whatever.
It was outlawed during the massacre of Wounded Knee. They were holding a religious ghost dance when that happened. That's when it was outlawed. And was never really legalized. Years ago, and Leonard and a few other people revived the ghost dance in Pine Ridge and were sent to jail for it. And this is on the Pine Ridge Reservation again. So they brought the Sundance tree, back to Rosebud, back to Crow Dog's Paradise. And from there, there were only a few dancers. Now there's over 400 dancers. And our Sundance is the only Sundance that we don't allow white people to dance.
When you say that the Sundance was prohibited back at Wounded Knee, you don't mean the occupation of Wounded Knee.
The massacre
at Wounded Knee. So is it legal now? I mean, would anyone have legal authority to prevent you from doing the Sundance now?
No. Because of the elements that are federally protected, like our eagle feathers and things, our different paraphernalia that we use. But it's getting out of hand. Even that's getting out of hand, because it's like, it's like the white man again. You know, I'm not saying this to be racist or prejudiced, but the white frame of mind, the society that we live in, it's like everything we've had, it's been taken over. Our lands have been taken over. Our whole lives have been taken over. The last thing we have left is our religion. Now everybody's cornering us again, you know. They want our religion. You know, just like up in Oregon, there's 400 white people sin dancing up there. I don't think they're authorized to do it. I don't feel they're authorized to do it. I think if white people want to do something, you know, they should support the Indian people, support the land struggles, the fishing rights struggles, you know, different struggles that are going on. If they really want to humble themselves and make it good, you know, they don't need to. Even through that, they have a blessing. They don't have to take it upon their own self to do the whole ritual, you know.
Can you describe what the Sundance is?
Well, it's a 4 days, well, it's actually 8 days. 4 days of purification, where you ready yourself, where you do your sweat lodges, your purification. You get all your things ready to dance. And the dance itself lasts 4 days, which is dancing before sunrise down to sundown all day. And there's piercing involved, you know, and different rituals take, there's seven rites, there's seven rituals that take place during this time.
The piercing, would you describe that a little bit?
Well, it's, the piercing itself is a blood sacrifice, that you sacrifice yourself, your flesh. When you humble yourself to the Great Spirit, you sacrifice, you want something in life, or you want something for somebody in life, something good. Maybe you're praying for somebody who's sick, and to pray to the tree, the sacred tree of life, and offer tobacco and pray and offer your flesh and humble yourself to the Great Spirit to look down upon you, your people to pity you.
Is the idea and part of this too that through suffering a certain amount of pain that you almost transcend the body, that the mind goes someplace else?
Well, it depends. It depends on how far you can go today.
You mean how extreme you can endure?
Yes, well, I think that's about all I'd like to say
right.
about that.
Let me ask you about what you wouldn't want to say more. Do you find that people misinterpret
people
something like the Sundance?
Yes, mm-hmm. People might misinterpret it.
And you're probably afraid that...
And I don't want to really go into it.
Right, and you're probably afraid that if it's misinterpreted, then someone might try to prevent it from continuing. Like
well,
it had been prevented in the past.
Yeah, there was a movie I seen, which is two white guys during a Sundance, their own kind of Sundance. First, they shoot a golf ball down the hill. And then next thing you know, this guy's pierced with some kind of a iron hook, like a, you know, something you'd put a slab of meat on, you know, in a locker. And he was all fully naked, and he had something on his his privates. You know, it was really something that wasn't, you didn't see him pray, you didn't see him, I mean, it was just nothing. All it was just being, all I could see was he was just being a masochist.
I think the movie's Ritual Sacred and Profane. Is that the film you're talking about?
I know it's been out for a couple of years,
yeah.
And we just seen it recently.
I think I know the film you're talking about, and it makes it seem like these rites are for some kind of sadomasochistic exhilaration.
You have, there's no feeling. I watched the whole movie. There's no feeling, no spiritual feeling at all. I didn't see him pray once. There was nothing. There was just nothing to that. That's what I mean. You know, people go taking it upon themselves to do their own way, and they're going to jeopardize our Indian religion. People like that.
Now, you have four children?
Yes.
Right? And they're being brought up by you very differently than you were brought up. And I'm wondering what that makes you think about as you watch your children come of age in a family that's really returned to Native American ceremonies and spirituality and everything else.
Well, my oldest son, the one that was born in Wounded Knee, Pedro.
Yeah.
He dropped out of school. He's 17 years old. He has his own drum group called the Eagle Lake Singers. And he has his own group of young people that go around, you know, singing. And he makes his money that way. Also, he's learning the medicine way. But my other three smaller children, like they're two boys, 11, 9, and a daughter, 7, I'd like them to finish their school. But always keep in track. You see, there is, you know, I let them expose themselves to the TV.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think there's anybody that doesn't watch TV nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
And I let them, you know, open their minds and they could see what's going on in the white world. I let them see what's going on in South Africa, what's going on in Central and South America, all over the world. And so I expose them to things like that, but also I take them to ceremonies whenever I go to participate in the ceremonies and put their interest in the ceremonies and to always have that spirituality and their culture and traditions, but also to educate themselves and have, like, you know, like the best of two worlds.
Mm-hmm. Would you like for them to live on the reservation after they've grown up, or do you just figure whatever they want to do is fine? Or
I'd like them to be close to home and marry in our own tribe.
Uh-huh.
Because there's really nothing out there. Now that I've lived out of the reservation, there's really nothing in the city that I could see that would benefit my children.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your life. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mary Crowdog's new memoir is titled Lakota Woman. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.